To prepare for the Divas Live, Miss Ross slash Supremes tribute, Trey was schooling me on all these Motown moments, and I was getting into her feeling, but how to integrate with Donna Summer was not as clear. I have such a tender memory connected with Donna Summer. I was quite young and at a publicly funded New York City summer sleepaway camp for kids. Let's just say it was not the most organized, and the staff were practically kids themselves. It was predominantly Black, and I was one of the very few mixed or light-skinned children there, and the only blondish one. But I most certainly was not having more fun. Rather, I was a flashpoint for animosity. None of the girls liked me. Why are they mad at me? I wondered. I didn't understand then. It wasn't just the light skin and blondish hair, if that weren't enough. Khalil liked me. Khalil was the cutest boy in the whole camp. He had dark, curly brown hair, caramel skin, and greenish eyes. I was also taller than he was, so I think the girls also thought I was too old for him, even though we were the same age. At any rate, the dreamiest boy at the nightmare camp thought I was cute. There was a closing day dance, and just as the first bird-twinkling flute sound with soaring strings and the melodic oohs began, Khalil walked over to me. He took my hand and, "Last dance, last chance for love," slowly started to fill the room. We went out to the dance floor, and our little selves moved in a waltz-like sway until the song broke out into the bright and happy up-tempo part. Then we jumped around in our own disco ball world, letting jealous girls made mean by harsh environments melt away. I carried that less-than-ideal experience of being at a public camp with me. It inspired me to conceive Camp Mariah, a summer camp focused on career awareness. I intimately understood there were countless children who didn't have access to resources at their hands, space under their feet, and sky above their heads. The first fundraiser was a Christmas concert at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Harlem in 1994, where I performed All I Want for Christmas Is You live for the first time. It stood as one of the largest fundraisers ever for the Fresh Air Fund, Camp Mariah's amazing partner. The Fresh Air Fund's Camp Mariah allowed me to create what I didn't have for thousands of deserving children. It has been not only fulfilling, but healing. So for me, Miss Summer's classic hit was the soundtrack to Camp Khalil, that innocent childhood moment, and there weren't many. I had never met her. Divas Live is a live concert, but it's taped in front of an audience at Radio City Music Hall. There were crew and people bustling all about. Everyone was excited about the arrival of the icon, Miss Ross. And I was having my own current big pop culture moment celebrating Rainbow, my seventh consecutive album to produce number one hits on the Billboard Hot 100. Heartbreaker was my 14th. We were doing a walkthrough of the staging and preparing for a run-through of the Supremes medley without Miss Ross. Donna Summer quietly came up, appearing shy and uncomfortable. No one said much as she went off to the side to have a conversation. I think about the teleprompter, which was scrolling lyrics to Baby Love. Then someone came and held up three hideous green sequin gowns. They were cheap costume types, nowhere near couture. Putrid. Who do they think is wearing that? I thought, because I'm not wearing that. I was sure Miss Ross would find them distasteful, to say the least, too. The next thing I knew, someone came over and told me Miss Summer wouldn't be doing the performance with us, and she left. Oh, okay. There was no time to find a Cindy Birdsong. She replaced Florence Ballard in the Supremes. I don't know what made Miss Summer bow out. If it was the dresses, I certainly don't blame her, but it looked like this year's Divas Live was going to be another wild ride. So now I was adjusting to the notion of doing a duet with Miss Ross. Of course, that was exciting, but the green abominations? No, ma'am. I would not be foiled by bad fashion on that particular night, not in front of Miss Ross, who was a well-documented international fashion icon. Growing up, I so vividly recall seeing giant black and white posters of Diana Ross all over New York City. She was wearing a white t-shirt with rolled-up sleeves and worn-in jeans. Her hair was imperfectly, perfectly slicked back and tucked behind her ear, and she was in minimal makeup. It was très chic. She was so beautiful. My eye couldn't help but focus on her gaze. The poster simply had her first name, Diana, written in large lowercase letters off to the side. I pasted that image on my inner inspiration board and subsequently pulled it out for my number one's cover. The composition was different, but I was inspired by the poster's simplicity and intensity. From the beginning, I sought to make timeless, not trendy images, and Miss Ross is a trailblazer in creating modern, classic, high-glamour iconography. I made it known that I would not be wearing the shiny green horror. I don't ever leave the house without my own wardrobe possibilities because in this business, you never really know what might happen. And something very tacky was happening this night. I had a plan. Since Donna Summer had backed out, I offered this to Miss Ross. Well, I have a dress. I actually have two dresses that are the same if you wanted to look at them. Donatella Versace had made me two fine metallic mesh link mini toga style numbers, one gold and one silver, and I had brought them both with me. What a perfect night to have options. Yeah, let me see the dress, Diana said. This is a woman who had been in countless gorgeous dresses, made fashion statements in every language, and I was humbly offering my dress, fabulous as it was, to her. Needless to say, I was nervous. I presented the tiny backless dresses to her, and she took the silver one. Yes. I promised not to bend over. Those were her first words as she tiptoed out on the stage like a diva nymph with an afro in the mini metallic silver sheath. She made it her own. I joined her in the gold version, and we stopped in the name of love for the people. The memory of having her teaching me the hand choreography for the song is sitting in my treasure box of all-time precious moments. I felt a love supreme. Recently, I've been reflecting on something Miss Ross said to me that time in London. I had sold tens of millions of records, and I was rolling deep with a big team, makeup artist, hairstylist, wardrobe stylist, publicist, manager, and various assistants. As she was flawlessly putting on her own makeup, she went to beauty school too. She said, Mariah, someday you're not going to want to have all these people around you. I believe that someday is not far away. One final diva moment. For the 1998 MTV VMAs, Whitney and I were opening the show and presenting the Best Male Video Award. It was supposed to be a whole staged Clash of the Divas stunt where we would enter from opposite sides of the stage and meet in the middle, only to discover we had on the same dress, a chocolate Vera Wang slip-style gown. We did some cute banter, nice dress, and they told me it was one of a kind. Then I said something like, it's a good thing I come prepared, and reached behind me to detach the long skirt portion of the dress, revealing an asymmetrical mini as I declared, try it on me! Then Whitney said, I can do better. And also ripped away the long piece of her dress, showing a new and different shape. We had a great laugh about it, but the gag is the moment that almost didn't happen. When I showed up at the venue, my dress had not arrived. Because the whole opening revolved around the dresses, it wasn't like I or anyone could just whip out a replacement. There was a panic. Apparently, the dress was still at the showroom, and so production arranged for a police escort for the dress, clearing the streets to get it up to the theater on time. That day, the police saved my one-of-a-kind dress moment. If only someone could have saved our once-in-a-lifetime Whitney Houston. A little bit about a few good men. Carl. Karl Lagerfeld was always very nice to me, which was not the case with some of the more haughty haute couture houses. We did a fashion shoot together for America Magazine, which was a new, quote, luxury urban publication launched in the early 2000s when the words luxury and urban were not common neighbors. The magazine and Carl were willing to go to a newer, fresher visual place with me. Carl produced and photographed the cover shoot. He captured me in both an intimate and a very glamorous light, giving you a little Marilyn Monroe by Eve Arnold vibe. They are, to this day, some of my most cherished portraits. Carl also photographed my V Belong Together, V magazine cover during the launch of The Emancipation of Mimi. The giant V logo was designed with a pattern from my Dior diamond bracelet. Absolute perfection. Love, Stephen Gann. Once Carl made me a very special couture dress for a big event. It was just beautiful, black satin with a deep V in the back. I wore it with my hair parted down the middle, slicked back, I very rarely wear it this way, and held with an ornament. It was giving a very classic, high fashion look. Because the dress was made of silk satin, though, which can be reflective, it requires proper lighting, in my opinion, every situation really does. I looked heavier in most of the photos as I featured the details in the back. The flashes made my ass look huge. Keep in mind, these were the days before ample booties, faux or authentic, were accepted or celebrated in the mainstream. Back then, I wasn't allowed to have an ass. The traditional press was very, oh my God, Becky, look at her butt. It was beyond frustrating. I was in this gorgeous dress, serving a classic couture look, and the press had to criticize my butt and foil the moment. I wasn't that far removed from the time when I couldn't afford actual food, and so I had no curves to attack. Mercifully, my then hairdresser Lou took the picture of me in the dress, sitting with my friend Rachel, and superimposed Marilyn Monroe on the other side of me, altering my original bad feelings about being photographed looking curvy and illustrating how creativity and vision can change perceptions, people, and points of view. That little black dress had a big impact, as did Mr. Karl Lagerfeld himself, both one of a kind to me. Mandela. When Oprah invites you to go to South Africa, you drop everything and go. When Oprah invites you anywhere, you go, but this was super major. It was something pretty extraordinary, even for her, the opening of her Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls. It was a once-in-a-lifetime privilege to be among the few people she invited, including Tina Turner, Sidney Poitier, Mary J. Blige, and Spike Lee. And then I was one of the even fewer people she selected to personally meet the phenomenal, transformational figure, Nelson Mandela. I was brought into a small, simple, elegant room where Mr. Mandela was sitting in a lone gray wingback chair in one of his signature patterned shirts. He looked like a king. He looked like a father. I was with him for just a moment, but what an incredible, powerful moment. I leaned down to hug him, and in that brief embrace, I felt the energy of ancient ancestry and of the future, of struggles and sacrifice, of unshakable faith and vision, of revolutionary love. Mr. Mandela smiled at me, and in an instant, I felt my very constitution change. Ali. Muhammad Ali was turning 60 years old, and a CBS television special was being produced in celebration of his triumphant life. It was 2002, right after Will Smith portrayed him in the film Ali. I was asked to close the show with the Happy Birthday song. I had admired Mr. Ali immensely since childhood. He was one of the few people my entire disjoint family came together on. If he was on TV, we would all gather around. All of us agreed Muhammad Ali was undeniably the greatest. He was a big presence to me, like Michael Jackson status big. Inspired by the Marilyn moment when she famously sang to President Kennedy, I did a little rearrangement of the classic and sang soft and breathy at the top.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to the greatest.
After which, I moved into a big vocal gospel choir type rendition. Of course, I was honored to have the opportunity. However, I did not realize my singing to an icon inspired by another icon might have been a bit improper. You see, I was dressed in a simple icy pink silk short slip dress, and I did a few kitschy winks and shimmies during my performance. I was thinking, of course, everyone is in on the reference. What I didn't take into consideration was that Mr. Ali was Muslim, as were his wife and daughters. I also didn't know at the time that Muslim women dress and act modestly. Mr. Ali and his wife were seated in special chairs at the foot of the stage. As part of the performance, I was to walk down the stairs and sing right in front of him. I must have appeared to literally be in my underwear to him and his wife. The camera was cutting to him so the audience could see how animated he was, seemingly trying to get out of his chair with excitement, which, at that stage in the progression of his Parkinson's syndrome, was not an easy task, but which also caused a delighted reaction from the audience. Well, most of them. Thank God, during the performance, I didn't know I was being inappropriate to his family. None of the producers brought this small but significant religious respect issue to my attention. You know, they could have just said, maybe tone down the cute kitten moves and bring the hem down a little. Perhaps some sleeves would be nice. I didn't know. I truly hope the family forgave my youthful ignorance and inexperience. Legends and heavy hitters like Angela Bassett and Diane Carroll were there. At the end of my song, Will Smith was to stand on his other side, and he and I would help Mr. Ali walk up to the stage for a finale. All the presenters and performers were gathered, and there was a huge confetti drop, and I was on the arm of one of my absolute heroes. In all the festive mayhem, he leaned over and whispered in my ear, "You're dangerous." Mind you, he wasn't talking very much at that point, but I heard him loud and clear. We both had a private laugh about it. The man, the people's champion, who knocked out some of the toughest men in the world and knocked down some of the toughest racial barriers, used his precious breath to joke with me that I was dangerous. After that experience, proclaiming a moment legendary elevated it to a whole new weight class. Stevie. "What color are the lights on the Christmas tree? What do they look like?" I overheard Stevie Wonder ask his brother as he led him through the MGM Grand. We were both there for the Billboard Music Awards. He had come to present me with the Artist of the Decade Award. Of all the musicians and all the music I've been inspired by, Stevie Wonder would have to be my favorite. As a writer and composer, he is a deep diver. He goes all the way to the floor of his soul and brings back treasures so vivid, so full of emotion, they sonically shift your composition. As a singer, he delivers with complete honesty and heart. He is truly my diamond standard. I have had the privilege to work with him a few times. Once, he even played me some new material he was working on and asked my opinion. One of the greatest songwriters ever casually let me listen to his work and was genuinely interested in my feedback as a musician. A musical moment I will always treasure was an ad-lib he did on my song, "Make It Look Good," on "Me, I Am Mariah," the elusive chanteuse. Right at the very beginning, he says or plays,
okay,
through his harmonica, and then laughs his sweet, brilliant, healing laugh, and then the song begins. It was like a little blessing before the meal. He played his distinctive harmonica throughout the whole thing, as only Stevie Wonder can. I often think about that moment when he asked about the Christmas lights on the tree. This man, who has brought so much pure joy to people all around the globe, spanning generations through the power of his incredible musical contribution, a man who has lit up the world with his presence and his songs, a man who has done so much for humanity, was asking to have a twinkle described to him. In that moment, Mr. Wonderful showed me how not to take the simple things for granted and confirmed a Christmas tree can bring happiness, seen and unseen, as long as it is made from love. When I received the Billboard's Artist of the Decade Award, I declared, "Now I can be who I really am," because I had just finished the Rainbow album and was on my road to emancipation. Receiving that recognition was a huge accomplishment, yet what I received from Stevie Wonder transcends statues, accolades, and all decades. Prince. Prince gave me a Bible, bound in deep brown leather with gold embossed letters. I still have that holy book sent to me from a brilliant being, a brother angel who came to my aid in difficult times more than once. Prince defended me as an artist. Around the time of Butterfly, a couple of label executives who shall remain nameless because I don't really know them, were questioning my musical direction in conversation with him. By that time, he had reached guru status as a musician, which didn't stop labels from trying to screw him as a recording artist. When it comes to money and power, nothing and no one is sacred, not even music royalty. They asked him, "Why is she trying to be so urban, and what is she doing?" "I think that's just her shit. That's what she really likes," was his transcendent answer. Exactly right. It's just her shit. Namaste, suckers. When I first met Prince, he told me he loved Honey. Oh my God. Prince knows my song, I shouted in my head. I was over the moon. The maestro of modern music knew my song. We went on to talk about songwriting and the treachery of the industry in subsequent casual meetings at parties or a club. Prince was notorious for randomly, mystically appearing at a nightclub. He was always very giving of his time with me. One night, he, JD, and I stayed up all night talking about the state of the industry and how, as new leaders, we could gain more independence, agency, and ownership over our work. Then one day, I got the invitation to Paisley Park. I had frequently fantasized about writing with him, like Wendy and Lisa or Sheila E., all incredible, under-celebrated musicians. I really, really wanted to write and record a Purple Rain-esque ballad duet. I mean, who didn't? But I know it would have been pretty perfect. I remember when I arrived at the Paisley Park compound. From the outside, it looked like an unremarkable series of big white structures, almost like a big car dealership. But then I went inside and saw the magnificent purple motorcycle from Purple Rain. I knew I had entered a whole nother world. I brought Prince sketches of a song I had been playing around with. My process with writing partners is to come in with some concepts, lyrical or melodic sketches, then go back and forth with ideas. We did a lot of talking. I think it was a bit of a test. You see, Prince was a real writer and composer. A lot of people claim they are, but we know. I think he wanted to see where my head and my writing chops were. I was already thinking about songs for Silk, the girl band I had in Glitter, who I loosely modeled after Vanity Six. I talked to him about how I wanted to use Nasty Girl, the song he wrote for Vanity Six, as a sample for a film I was working on, similarly to the way I ended up using I Didn't Mean to Turn You On. Prince challenged me. "That's Vanity's song," he said. He asked me why I couldn't be inspired by it, as Puff and Biggie were with "You Nasty Boy, You Nasty." I let him know, rather than just the catchy words, I loved the structure and the beat of the song, the feeling. Prince wasn't at all being shady. He was being protective. He was being instructive. He told me to finish the song I had begun, and we would work together on another new one. I never finished the song, and we never made our song together. I really wish we had. Remaking The Beautiful Ones would be the closest I would get. Protect your ideas, protect your music, was the message I got from that trip to Paisley Park. When the Glitter debacle was in full swing, Prince reached out to me. He called me often, and what he said to me then, I always will cherish inside. He was deeply private, and I will keep the details to myself. But I will say his wise words soothed me. He gave me encouragement like the big brother I never had. I listened to Prince's music nearly daily, and to this day. Rock and Roll can identify all his G-rated songs. I don't know if he could ever know what his connecting with me in that storm meant to me. It gave me hope in a desolate time. Prince had his own singular and wondrous relationship with God. He composed his own concept of spirituality and sexuality, and it was as special and unique as he was. But in the end, when my soul was in need, Prince sent me the sacred scriptures, the beloved books, the Word of God, bound together. Prince helped save me on a soul level when I needed it the most, and through his music, he continues to save the day. Every day.
Them babies.
Boy meets girl and looks in her eyes. Time stands still and two hearts catch fire. Off they go, roller coaster ride.
Love story. Much of the iconic television of the 1990s missed me. I never got to watch Seinfeld. Now I'm such a stan of comedians and cars getting coffee. And I had no time for and was isolated from actual friends, let alone sitcom ones. All my time was spent hustling, working, praying, and making Mariah Carey. I barely watched children's shows when I was a child, so I certainly didn't know of any Nickelodeon shows or their stars. I had no clue all that was all that, and I had no idea who Nick Cannon was until 2002 when I saw the film Drumline, which I loved. I thought he was very good in it. I also thought he was cute. Very. That was all. A couple of years later, Brat was telling me, "He loves you. He always talks about you," referring to Nick. She was a fan of Wildin' Out, his hip-hop-infused improv sketch comedy show on MTV, which I also had no knowledge of. Wildin' Out came out the same year as The Emancipation of Mimi, which consumed me in a good way, finally. It was an incredible moment of long-awaited phenomenal success. I was hearing one of several of my songs from that album on the radio 30 times a day. It was a massive moment for my fans, too. It was what they needed. They need to see me come back like that. I really believe, for better or worse, the Lamely, the fans and I, go through things together. We Belong Together was a colossal song. It was breaking chart and airplay records all over the United States and internationally. It became my 16th number one record on the Billboard Hot 100, also making me the first woman artist to concurrently hold the number one and number two spots with Shake It Off. It ended up staying in a top 10 position for 23 weeks and charted for 43 weeks total. It tied for the third longest-running number one song in U.S. chart history behind One Sweet Day, Billboard's most popular song of the 90s. Billboard named We Belong Together Song of the Decade. Song of the what? For the 2000s and the ninth most popular song of all time. It won two Grammys, two Soul Train Awards, and Song of the Year at the ASCAP Awards and BMI Awards, among others. It even won a Teen Choice Award, the Choice Love Song Award. I didn't know Nick was set to present the award to me. Apparently, he insisted to the Teen Choice producers. The show was loud, bright, and zany. The award is a surfboard. I recall first seeing Nick and taking in his curious, oversized, nautical-inspired ensemble consisting of giant white shorts, a big ocean blue polo shirt, a lemon-yellow sweater tied around his neck, ankle socks, and sneakers. After he presented me with my board award, I said, "I heard about all the nice things you've been saying about me." With a genuine beaming smile and a flame in his eyes, he replied, "If you give me a chance, I'll prove all of it is true." A cute moment. Very. More time passed and Brat wouldn't let up, insistent that Nick and I really connect. We began talking on the phone almost daily. Then, finally, we did get together and it was irresistibly fun. And at the time, I was all about having fun. I wasn't ready to be grown up again. I had had to be so grown so fast professionally and especially in my first marriage. Marrying was something I vowed never to do again. I missed out on so much as a teen, and Nick, who had a perpetual teen spirit, was charmingly refreshing. He also felt safe to me. Look, I was hanging out with Dipset in this era, and while it was a blast, the element of legitimate danger was ever present, okay? Besides, no matter how famous or fine, no matter how well they could rhyme, I held a strict no rappers rule. I was very serious about protecting myself from being labeled that girl. It was critical to me to maintain, most importantly, my self-respect, but also my professional respect from the tight boys club of artists, producers, and management I collaborated with. I worked with some of the greatest, and some unknown at the time, hip-hop artists of all time. I didn't want things to ever get reality show messy up in the studio. And the Rat Packs will talk amongst themselves. Come on, they talk for a living. It was bad enough there were already a plethora of ridiculous rumors about me sleeping with rappers anyway. If you're not careful, all your business could be all up in somebody's bars.
'Cause they be all up in my business like a Wendy interview.
After Wendy Williams went on a tangent about me on the radio, the New York Post picked up the story and I woke up to the headline, Sexcapades, with my photo underneath. They called me, JD, Q-Tip, and some of my creative collaborators the, quote, hard-partying rap posse. I can't. I was not going to give the mill actual fodder. What mattered was that I knew what the truth was, and I was committed to holding to it. But I regarded Nick as a producer, comedian, and actor. I had no idea he had real rapper aspirations. He laughed a lot, and he made me laugh. We made each other laugh a lot. We talked about life and music. I just wanted to be around him. Once, I even left a date with a very handsome and legendary basketball player to ride in the car with Nick so he could be the first to listen to my newest album, E equals MC squared. I was excited about it, and I wanted to listen to it with him. During this time, I was finally pulling my whole self together. I had already gone through a spiritual cleansing, getting baptized, and continuing my therapy. Now, I was focusing on my physical self as well. I was working intensely with an amazing trainer, Patricia. The first single for the new album was Touch My Body, so I had to get fit in the body for preparation. I was feeling stronger, and I hadn't felt good about myself in a while. We were going to cast my new friend Nick in the Touch My Body video, since he was a comedian and we were doing a humorous twist with it. I mean, come on, what other direction could I go with a lyric like,
'Cause if you run your mouth and brag about this sacred rendezvous, I will hunt you down.
Otherwise, it would have been a stalker movie. But the role in the video was for a computer geek, and while Nick was really funny, he wasn't a convincing geek. Jack McBrayer, however, was a genius pick, and we had the absolute best time making the video. Thanks to my fans who really got behind the song, knowing how significant it would be, Touch My Body became my 18th number one single. I'm forever grateful to the family of Lambs. I'm also grateful for everybody at the record label who was so devoted to the album and to me. It was my biggest so far. It seemed to do the impossible by pushing me past the record long held by Elvis Presley for the all-time most number one singles. We did end up casting Nick as the love interest in the next video, Bye Bye, which was shot in Antigua. Our chemistry was natural, strong, and familiar. The comfort and the intimacy captured on film were real. And after the shoot, we didn't say bye-bye to each other for a long time. I was enjoying having a fresh, new romantic moment with Nick. We even joked about how we were going to pace ourselves and not rush anything. Once, he sent me a gigantic, gorgeous bouquet of flowers while I was in London, signing the card from a Pace University dropout because things were going fast. Fast. We'd quickly established a solid friendship, then even more quickly, hopped on our own underground love roller coaster. We could share our layers with each other. We connected on some very core things. He was a good guy. He was faith-based. He was ambitious. He had been in the entertainment industry for a long time, so he understood the madness. He paid attention to me. The power dynamics between us felt even. I was clear with Nick that I was not at all interested in becoming physically vulnerable again. I was not going there unless there was complete commitment, which at the time meant marriage. So obviously I would have to break the vow I made to myself about never marrying again. Nick respected my position. I sincerely thought I would never have kids. Our relationship changed that. We talked very seriously about having children, and that changed everything. Having children together became our reason. Our desire to have children became a force of nature and why we got married so quickly.
Way back then it was the simple things, anklets, nameplates that you gave to me, sweet tots, ring pops, had the candy bling, and you were my world.
Candy bling. The whole world is pink yet lavender when you're in a good swirl, and we were in a sweet swirl. A swirl is the opposite of a spiral. Nick's proposal to me was wrapped in childlike romance. He was always eating candy, which the eternally 12 in me found totally acceptable for a grown man. On the evening the Empire State Building was scheduled to be lit up in my signature pink yet lavender colors in celebration of a native New Yorker making history with Touch My Body setting a new record, Nick and I were chilling in the Moroccan room, talking, laughing, and listening to music. With that enormous, luminous smile of his, Nick gave me one of those big candy ring pops. It was among other confections inside a little metal Hello Kitty lunchbox. I thought, okay, this is cutely festive. I'll eat some celebratory candy with him. Disguised as a candy pop ring was a large, clear, emerald-cut diamond flanked by two moon-cut diamonds surrounded by smaller pink diamonds, a very real ring. It was dazzling and matched the situation. I wore a lavender dress with a pink cardigan, and we took a helicopter ride over the city and marveled at the lights and reveled in our moment. That night, Nick and I sparkled and shined brighter than the Empire State Building itself. Our wedding was just about the absolute opposite of my first. It was a total spiritual celebration, not mostly an industry production. It was intimate, maybe a dozen people in all. I had my pastor, Bishop Clarence Keaton, come in from Brooklyn to officiate. We held it at my beautiful house in Eleuthera, Bahamas. The white silk matte jersey gown I wore was custom made for me by Niall Simolo, an independent woman's designer I'd worked with for years, not by a high-profile fashion house. It had a simple, form-fitting silhouette, and my shoulder-length veil required no handlers, only a few bobby pins. My ex-sister's first son, Sean, whom I lovingly refer to as my nephew-slash-brother-slash-uncle-slash-cousin-slash-grandfather, because he really has been the blood family member who has been with me and for me in so many capacities, and I cherish him, walked me down the sandy, salmon-colored aisle. And after the ceremony, I kicked off my Manolos and twirled barefoot in the fine pink grains, allowing the hem of my cloud-colored gown to swish and sway in the aqua-blue waters. We basked in the glow of the Bahamian sunset and genuine love. It was ours to have and to hold. We didn't overstage anything. We didn't even really care about photos, though ironically, they ended up as a cover story for People. This time, I was sipping fine champagne with fine friends. No more lonely, salty tears and sad, sugary daiquiris. It was near Christmas time, and I was 10 weeks pregnant. It was our Christmas miracle. Nick and I were beyond excited. We kept our little secret just between us, but of course, I planned to make the revelation as an event over our Christmas vacation. I was even designing tree ornaments as the announcements for friends and family. But on a routine checkup to our obstetrician's office, the sonogram was silent. The sacred, rhythmic swoosh of our baby's heartbeat was gone. And in that silence, I could hear my own heart crack. I survived my miscarriage, but I will never forget it. After the devastation, I made it my mission to prepare my body to healthily hold and sustain new life. I totally detached from the industry machine and went underground to heal and build. It was the first time in my entire career when I turned down work to concentrate on my well-being. I passed on some big acting opportunities after Precious. That's where I really wanted to go. I employed mostly non-Western medicinal practices like Chinese herbs and acupuncture. I had meditation moments, and it's hard, whatever it took. Nothing mattered except putting myself in the best possible position to become and stay pregnant. All my efforts paid off double. The next time, we were blessed with the miracle pregnancy of the twins. Growing two humans was rough on my body. I gained over 100 pounds and got very ill. I developed poisonous edema. I was dangerously swollen, full of toxic fluid. I also developed gestational diabetes, but the most damaging of all my afflictions was the loneliness. All my fun party friends were nowhere around because I couldn't twirl around the city. I couldn't partake in splashes of wine and late-night gallivanting. On the contrary, I was in constant discomfort. Again, I didn't have a team that knew how to surround me with the proper care. I was often by myself, but fortunately this time I did have a mother-in-law who was there for me more than anything else. Nick's mom, Beth, would come and rub my back. The backaches were debilitating, and feet, which were under excruciating strain from all the weight. She helped me slather on my very special cream that I developed with my dermatologist on my giant, tight drum of a stomach. Over 100 pounds gained at no stretch marks upon the tummy. She would just sit with me and her grandbabies growing inside my big belly. A kindness. Nick, on the other hand, didn't quite comprehend the enormity of what I was going through. Once, we were at an appointment with our specialist for high-risk pregnancies. While I was hooked up to a machine with the weight of two human beings and a small lake of fluid filling my entire body, the memory of comfort of any kind far in the distance, my kind older doctor, in his thick Middle Eastern accent, looked over at my sulking second husband and said, "Poor Nick, he is so exhausted." The recording of Merry Christmas to You is what held me together during my treacherous pregnancy. I loved creating the first Christmas album so much, I thought doing another would keep me from slipping into sadness. I totally immersed myself in the writing and recording. I wanted this album to be more diverse and the production lusher. I was collaborating with a broader range of producers, like James Poyser from The Roots. We made "When Christmas Comes" as a classic R&B song, and it's one of my all-time favorites. And Broadway musical producer Mark Shaman, the 1950s-esque standard "Christmas Time is in the Air Again." In addition to my own go-to favorite partners like Randy Jackson, Big Jim Wright, and JD. The doctors wanted me to be on bed rest, but how? Tell me, how do I rest? As I was being pulled down from the loneliness and the fluid I was retaining, working on this album was lifting me. I recorded most of it in our house in Bel Air, which once belonged to the late, legendary Farrah Fawcett. In my many imaginative roles as a child, one of my all-time favorites was private investigator Jill Monroe of Charlie's Angels. No surprise, I was fascinated by her hair. The perfection of the color and cut just laid. I've paid it several homages in my career. I recall my mother telling me her hair was, quote, frosted, which my 6 or 7-year-old mind heard as frosting. And I just knew someday I would slather my hair with a chocolate and vanilla swirl and come out looking just like Jill. One of the highlights of the album was arranging the "O Come All Ye Faithful" Hallelujah chorus duet with Patricia Carey, where I was able to blend opera and gospel. We performed it on my ABC Christmas special with a full orchestra and choir. and with me, very pregnant, three generations on stage together. During this time, I also recorded When Do the Bells Ring for Me with the incomparable Tony Bennett for his Duets 2 album. The timeless icon himself came to my home studio to record. I squeezed my big pregnant self into my little pink vocal booth, and we set up microphones outside in the studio for Mr. Bennett so that our voices would be separate and smooth, but we could be in the same room, which was very important to Mr. Bennett. I recall looking out my little window at a living legend singing with me in my house, a moment. I never sang with a trio before, was his witty remark, as there were technically four hearts beating in the session, a memory that will always remain with me. I promoted and performed Merry Christmas to You while enormously and dangerously pregnant. One invitation I simply could not turn down was performing a song I wrote called One Child for the 29th annual Christmas in Washington special. It was filmed in the majestic National Building Museum, and I was singing with a full choir of beautiful and hope-filled young people backing me up. President Obama, the First Lady, Sasha, and Malia were in the front row, directly in my line of sight, beaming with dignity. It was such an honor to perform for the Obamas and, by extension, the country again. For the finale, all the performers were gathered on stage, and the First Family joined us. Earlier, Nick had suggested I tell FLOTUS our then secret. She and President Obama were going down the line, thanking all of us. And when she came to me, I seized the moment and whispered in her ear that I was having twins. After I sang One Child, Michelle Obama, our forever historic First Lady, became the first to know we were having two children. What a blessing. Monroe and Moroccan got their names because I wanted them to have the initials MC, like me. My precious daughter was obviously named after my childhood hero. The sonogram revealed her posed like a Hollywood starlet reclining on a chaise in the womb. We arrived at Moroccan because both Nick and I loved the name Rakim because he is one of the greatest rappers to ever do it. Moroccan was a bit of a hybrid name. It rhymed with Rakim, it's a gorgeous, mystical country where I had a special experience, and it's the name of the room where so many creative and magical moments happen, including Nick presenting me with my candy bling. It was wonderful and fun when them babies were little. Together, Nick and I lavished them with as much joy, attention, and safety as we could. But along with double the joy came double the responsibility. It was a lot of work and a lot of having to be home and be available. Making the necessary adult adjustments to being working parents and entertainment took its toll on our relationship, and the end of our marriage came fast as it began. Even though we had prenuptials in place, the divorce took 2 years to become final and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees.
I call your name, baby, subconsciously. Always somewhere, but you're not there for me.
Faded. Honestly, I think Nick and I could have worked it out between the two of us, but egos and emotions got inflamed, which can translate into many billable lawyer hours, and ultimately, it did. It was tough. We both wanted to make sure everything was cool for our family. We will always be family, and we make it work. We still have fun, reminisce, and joke, and we both are certain that rock and roll are indeed our light. Every day, they give us new life.
I've often wondered if there's ever been a perfect family.
Petals. I don't wonder anymore. Now I know for certain that there's never been and probably never will be a perfect family. But I have finally found stability in the family I created. There are times I cannot believe I was a little girl who lived in shacks, who always felt unsafe, undercared for, lonely, and perpetually scared. I have wanted to go back in time to protect and rescue that little girl from the precarious world she was trapped in. And now I marvel at my own wonderful children, Monroe and Moroccan, and the safe and abundant environment that has been created for them. Rather than being uprooted 13 times, they live in multiple gorgeous, pristine, and palatial homes. Instead of exposed nails in the stairs and filthy carpeting, they run freely down long, shiny marble hallways, slide in their socks, and squeal with delight. In lieu of a three-legged rocking couch, they watch films on a cinema-style screen from a steady, luxurious, custom-made one of goose-down cushions that's bigger than my first apartment. My children are surrounded by my uninterrupted love. I have never been away from them for more than 24 hours, and when I am working, they are watched over by a loving family of friends and professionals. They have never, ever, ever been left alone. They have never wondered where I am or if their father knows what their lives are really like. They have multitudes of memories and images of being with two loving parents together. Their lives have never been threatened. Cops have never stormed our house. They probably have 300 shirts to rotate and donate, and their sweet, soft curls are deeply understood. They do not live in fear. They have never needed to escape. They don't try to destroy each other. My children are happy, and they play with each other, learn with each other, joke, laugh, and live with each other. And no matter what, they will always have each other. They are rock and roll for life. Of all the many gifts God has blessed me with, my songs, my voice, my creativity, my strength, my children are a vision more beautiful than I could have ever conceived. It is by divine design that the children of a wayward child, who as a child professed she would never have children, are so extraordinarily fortunate. And though I've worked so hard for so long, it is still miraculous to me that in one lifetime such a leap has been made for my mixed-up lineage. We have broken a cycle of brokenness. Guided by grace, I am emancipating myself from the bondage of all the dysfunction of my past, rerouting my legacy and rooting it in pure love. And the blessings keep flowing. 25 years after writing a love song for Christmas that came out of a deep desire for joy and peace in my own family, I have all I ever wanted, topped with big, happy, festive family holiday celebrations. Snow Globe of Joy. I was standing decked out in a bedazzling red sequin gown inspired by the dress Marilyn wore in the Two Little Girls from Little Rock number in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on a spectacular, cheerfully decorated stage at my sold-out 2019 Christmas show in Madison Square Garden. My face was aglow from the joy of the occasion, but mostly as a result of the gifted hands of my gorgeous, longtime makeup artist, Kiki confidant, and dear friend, Christopher Buckle. Rock and Roll, in their own little merry ensembles, they performed a special rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that night, were on one side, and Tanaka was on the other. Behind me were my singing siblings, my brother Trey, and sisters Tot and Tika, who have been with me through all my seasons, tumultuous and tranquil. And in front of me, yes, in front of me, were tens of thousands of my amazing, diverse, enormous family of loving fans. I looked out and saw fabulous flocks of lambs in sequin onesies and other such glitzy garb. The arena was overflowing with sequins, studs, and crystals, holding signs and holding hands. There were little girls in crushed velvet dresses on their father's big shoulders. There were old men with no hair next to young women in head wraps. There were black people, white, indigenous, Asian, Middle Eastern, and countless mixes and variations. Gay, straight, fluid, trans, non-binary, people who were liberal, conservative, devout, agnostic, abled and disabled, people of every shape, hue, persuasion, and belief you could imagine. And as I gazed upon the marvelous multitudes, as if a lone bright star was shining right down on her face, I saw Lauren, a woman who was once a 12-year-old girl who had the lyrics to Looking In written on the door of her bedroom in Tel Aviv. Now a woman who is an invaluable member of my inner team and a treasured, loyal friend. I saw the knowing eyes of girlfriends and colleagues, people I've worked with, laughed, and cried with during every era of my life. My universal family of fans who have given me unparalleled, unstoppable, unconditional support since day one were spread out before me like a crystal clear ocean of love. For so long, I wished I could get five people to be in harmony at Christmas time, and here I was in a family of thousands of lambs, fans, and friends, and everybody was singing, "All I Want for Christmas Is You," together. They were singing with me. They were singing to me. Our voices were ringing so loudly and jubilantly, all of New York City could have heard us and joined in. In that moment, we were all united in our own universe of the Christmas spirit. Tons of white confetti flakes came floating down on top of us from the ceiling. It was like the whole world was with me in one big snow globe of joy. The next day, I was utterly exhausted and entirely exhilarated as I woke up to the Billboard headline, "Wish Come True." Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You hits number one on the Hot 100 after 25-year wait. Wait, what? Right at the end of 2019, I got my 19th number one. The Lambs made it happen again. My fans made it the most streamed song globally in a single day ever. I had worked hard and focused with my small team to give the song big energy on its shining silver anniversary, but making it to number one? That's huge. That's only something genuine fans, not just marketing plans, can do. After the wonderful whirlwind of All I Want for Christmas Is You ended, I made my traditional sojourn to my own winter wonderland, Aspen, with blood and chosen family, Rock and Roll, Tanaka, Sean and his wife, two of my dogs, Cha-Cha and Muttley, in tow. I was ready to nestle in and let our new traditional festivities begin. The days were sparkling and crisp. The grassy fields outside our homey yet sprawling chalet were blanketed with thick crystal white snow, as if glittery clouds had settled down to sleep in our backyard. Content to stay in our cozy onesies all day, the kids and I put on our puffy coats and ski boots right on top of our PJs and dashed out into the fluffy blanket of flakes to make snow angels. Eyes pointed up at the bright blue sky, we let the fresh smell of pine waft over our faces and tickle our noses. Inside, the beautiful bustle of family warmed the whole house. From Handel's Messiah to the Jackson 5, Christmas music was the infinite soundtrack, with laughing, dogs barking, and kids scurrying as the backgrounds. The halls, the walls, everywhere was decked and decorated, and fires roared in the fireplaces. In the living room, the massive tree was filled with white lights, gold balls, cherubs, and gilded butterflies, and topped with a beautiful angel star with gold-tipped wings and cream gossamer fabric flowing down from them. In the family room is always another old-school-style tree with big, multicolored lights, giving a fuller, much happier Charlie Brown vibe. We decorate it with homemade ornaments and happy Polaroid pictures of each other. I also add cherished ornaments lambs from all over the world have sent me over the years. Garlands and lights cascaded down mantels and doorways, and white candles and poinsettias were all about. Cups were filled with rich hot cocoa and yummy butterscotch schnapps. At Christmas, I have time to cook my favorite dishes. My father's linguine with white clam sauce, for Christmas Eve, of course, and stuffed shells. Santa comes by the house to spread some cheer, and we ride and sing, "On a two-horse open sleigh." We sing carols and actually frolic in the snow. It is real. It is loud. It is fun. It is joy. It is my world. I was already feeling full of gratitude and hot chocolate and schnapps during our Aspen getaway holiday when another Billboard headline broke. Mariah Carey becomes first artist at number one on Billboard Hot 100 in four decades, thanks to All I Want for Christmas. Yes, thank you to the fans who have loved my little Christmas song so deeply, so much so that it held the number one spot on the charts for 3 weeks, making it the last number one song of 2019 and the first number one song of 2020, the first year of a new decade. Really? What is a decade again? After all the swirling, toasting, singing, and celebrating, folks peeled off to cozy up into their places for the night. The kids were snuggled up in the family room watching a movie, and everyone else was content in their bedrooms. I tiptoed quietly into the living room and sat by the fireplace. All was dark except for the stars twinkling outside of the big windows against the black blue sky and the warm amber glow from the fire. I reveled in a sweet, quiet, private moment with myself. I took it all in. I am peaceful. I am complete. Epilogue. Lord knows dreams are hard to follow, but don't let anyone tear them away. Hero. In the middle of a violent storm, very young, I was given a glimpse of God's vision for me. As a child awakened to my dream, I believed with my entire being in what I was meant to do and who I was meant to be long before anyone else did. And holding on to that belief required everything I had. Along the way, I was given signs of hope, but mostly I faced chaos and calamity, heartbreaks and brutal betrayals to derail me. Some almost killed me, or worse, almost killed my spirit. The toughest truth was that the people I loved the most hurt me the worst. The ones closest to me were the ones who came closest to stripping me of my dreams. If I have learned anything in this life worth sharing, it is protect your dreams. Even in the face of disadvantages and dysfunction, you can't let anybody define, control, or take away your vision of your life. Not your mother, brother, sister, father, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, fake friend, boss, bully, bigot, manager, partner, assistant, critic, cousin, uncle, auntie, classmate, mogul, predator, influencer, president, false preacher, fake teacher, co-worker, frenemy with a phone, coward with a camera, or a chicken with a keyboard. For I assure you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will tell this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible to you. Matthew 17:20. In the end, and in the beginning, it's all about faith for me. I can't define it, but it has defined me. Acknowledgements. This book would not be possible without the loving guidance of God. In loving memory of Lavinia Cole, aka Cousin Vinny, thank you for holding our family history and sharing it with me. Your participation in this book and in my life were invaluable. Thank you to my tribe of angels, Alfred Roy, Addie Mae Cole, Nana Reese, Mother Emma Cutright, and the Bishop. I feel you with me every day, carrying me higher. And for the people, the precious people, and there are many, who lift me up and hold me down daily, I thank you for all you have done and undone to help me bring my life to life. I'm eternally grateful, and please forgive me if I have left out your name. You are in my heart. My nephew/brothers/cousins/uncles/grandfathers, Sean and Mike, I treasure you endlessly. The gorgeous and gifted Christopher Buckle, the loving and caring Miss Ellen Green, Gigi, I said goodnight, the solid and steady Al Mack, and the hate to be boring Michael Richardson, and the incredible Brian Garten and his ever-tolerant family. Your collective support and protection have been vital to me, and I am eternally grateful. Without the deep understanding and friendship of Karen G., Rhonda Cowan, Stephen Hill, and Lee Daniels, a.k.a. Cot, I would not have made it. My cousins, Cece and Chris, our fun was like cooked food to me, still love you like rice and beans. To my four-legged family throughout the years who gave me unconditional love, Princess, Duke, got them balls, the ever-present Jackson P. Muttley Gore III, I love you always. The good Reverend Powell, Jilly Beans, Squeaky Beans, JJ, a.k.a. Jack Jr., that boy, Muttley, Jackie Lamb Chops, Pippity Dolomite, Queen Cha-Cha, the good girl, the baby, and the OG Clarence of Centerport, S-W-Y-W-T, shit where you want to, my friend, my heart, and the wonderfully unique Tanaka. Thank you for providing a beautiful and steady shoulder to lean on. I fly. Jay-Z, thank you for believing. Thank you for leading. And Sir J. Brown, Mr. Hank, and the entire Roc Nation team, Rob Light and the folks at CAA, Alan Grubman, Joe Brenner, the Stewarts, and my entire legal team, Bert Dexler, Lester Nispel, and Rosemary at Boulevard Management. I so appreciate all of your work on my behalf. My very special publisher and festive friend, Andy Cohen, love you much. My editor, James Melia, darling, and all at Henry Holt. Thank you for your patience, diligence, and good nature through it all. And to my writing partner, Michaela Angela Davis, Sisterhood is a strong, precious, spiritual, and powerful place. It is where we have lived together to tell this story. To Laron, thank you for being so brilliant, inspiring, and most of all, a true friend and wonderful human being.
Thank you
for encouraging me to listen to my songs and, more than anything, for reigniting me with my music. That's everything. And finally, but firstly and always, to my family of fans, there really are no words, but I will try. Many don't understand how real our relationship is, but for me, it is the realest I have ever known. You have literally given me life and saved my life time and time again. You can never know how I cherish every letter, poem, and book you've ever given me, every video, poster, and piece of merch you've made for me, and every single tattoo you've put on your body. Thank you for crying with me. Thank you for crying for me. Thank you for cheering me on and cheering me up. This book is for you. My truth is for you. And I hope it inspires you to live in yours.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Meaning of Mariah Carey. Written and performed by Mariah Carey. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Produced by Kat Lambrix and Michaela Angela Davis. Recorded by Brian Garden. Music mixed by Brian Garden. Edited and mastered by Real Audiobooks. Copyright 2020 by Mariah Carey. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.